From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today on the program, another protest at the state capitol. This one's different.
I would say the absence that's notable here is the trucks of businesses and the workers that, you know, were first to shut down. There were a lot of those at the last protest that aren't at this protest.
We'll check in on who's in the streets in Lansing and get a deeper dive into what's driving them.
Whenever you have the opportunity for mass mobilization and mass protests, there are going to be groups that take advantage of it.
Also, we'll speak with the owner of Avalon Breads in Detroit about the troubles she's run into with the small business loan program from the federal government.
You know, it was made thinking this is going to be a short problem. Well, nobody could have imagined how the economy has bottomed out.
Those stories and more just ahead on today's edition of Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Later in the hour, one Detroit business owner talks about the challenges of making a federal paycheck protection loan work for her 100-plus employees and what she thinks reopening might bring. But first, let's turn to Lansing. Protesters once again took to the streets today at Michigan's Capitol to protest the stay-at-home orders that have slowed the spread of COVID-19. Today's protest had a particular focus, asking Republican leaders to end Governor Whitmer's coronavirus emergency declaration. 2 weeks ago, a similar protest packed the streets, drawing a wide variety of Michiganders, from frustrated workers to Trump supporters to alt-right groups and white supremacists. Abigail Sensky is a politics reporter with public radio station WKAR, and she's on site at the Capitol. Abigail, how are you?
I'm good, April. How are you?
Okay. How many people showed up today?
So I would say conservatively, there are at least 300 people here, so more than were actually out on the Capitol grounds during the Operation Gridlock protest a couple weeks ago. Of course, that protest had thousands of people who stayed in their cars, but there are at least more people out on the Capitol lawn at this protest.
Can you hazard a guess at the number of people who were in their cars but chose not to go stand up next to the building today?
You know, there are cars that have been steadily streaming in a loop around the Capitol, but I would say it's at least 50 cars, if not more.
Does this protest feel very similar to the one that happened on April 15th?
It feels a little different, honestly. There are a lot more people out on the Capitol lawn. There are kind of the same groups of people. There's lots of Trump flags. There are several militias here providing what organizers call additional security in addition to the state police presence. There are lots of don't tread on me flags, recall Whitmer, and then there have been some signs that compare Governor Whitmer to Hitler. So I would say some of the more kind of fringe elements that were at the Operation Gridlock protest have also come out again for this one. But I would say the absence that's notable here is the trucks of businesses and the workers that, you know, were first to shut down. There were a lot of those at the last protest that aren't at this protest. It's much less about types of industry and regional-based exemptions and more wholesale opposition to stay-at-home orders and the COVID-19 response that has been going on in the state. And I would also say that it's not just unilaterally against Governor Whitmer. I've seen signs saying that Senate Majority Leader Mike Shirky and House Speaker Lee Chatfield are also to blame for this. And some protesters that I talked to said, you know, they just want lawmakers to move forward and start working together.
Abigail, you sound a little muffled. I'm guessing you're talking to us through your mask.
I am, yes.
How many other people there are using personal protective equipment?
I would say it's at least a third of the people out here on the lawn, which is more than at the last protest. A lot more people are wearing masks at this one, but I have talked to several folks who have elected not to wear masks, even if they are high risk.
You've talked to a range of folks down there today. What kinds of things did they have to say?
I would say the main through line is people who are out protesting here today believe that this is unconstitutional. They don't believe that the stay-at-home order is okay. They believe that it's an infringement of their rights, and the governor can't ask them to stay at home Several of them have also mentioned that they don't believe the governor has the ability to designate who's an essential worker and who's not an essential worker. And it's been a spectrum of people who believe, you know, some of them have said the initial stay-at-home order was necessary, and some of them go as far to say, no, we didn't need to take action.
Have you seen anyone from state government come out to greet the protesters or just come out and comment on the proceedings at all?
I have not personally seen representatives or senators come out here, but Mike Detmer, a candidate running against Alyssa Slotkin in the 8th Congressional District, was out here, and he did speak to the crowd today.
I remember the last time protesters were down at the Capitol, some office workers were waving American flags out their windows in support. Are you seeing any of that today?
No, I have not seen any flags that have been flown from Speaker Chatfield's office today.
You mentioned the police presence. Have you noticed any flashpoints between the protesters and the officers?
I have not noticed any clashes, but it's definitely a much heavier police presence than the last protest. I think, quite frankly, the city of Lansing was unprepared for how many people came out to the last protest. And so there's been, at some points, helicopters flying overhead, and at least one helicopter, and there's a much bigger presence of Michigan State Police, as well as police that are helping the city of Lansing as well.
Reporter Abigail Sansky of public radio station WKAR in Lansing. Abby, take care. Thanks for reporting in.
Of course.
The timing of today's protest is anything but accidental. Inside the Capitol building, Michigan's lawmakers have a decision to make. Chad Livengood is a senior editor at Cranes, and he joins us now. Chad, good to talk to you.
Thanks for having me back, April.
Can you remind us what's happening today that is significant in the timing of the shutdown protest?
Yeah, so today is the end of the 23-day extension that the legislature granted the governor back on April 7th for extending her emergency powers for managing the coronavirus pandemic. There is a big conflict, though, between the governor and the legislature. The governor has asked for a 28-day extension all the way to May 28th. Lawmakers only want to give her a week at a time, basically. But another issue here is sort of a very legal issue, is that regardless of what the legislature does today, the governor can extend the order with a different law. She has been using a 1976 emergency management law, and there's a law from 1945 from the end of the World War II that grants her almost all the same powers. So if the legislature decides to give her a one-week extension, the governor can just use this other law to extend the state of emergency by another 2 or 3 or 4 weeks or longer.
Chad, it feels like the air between the Republican legislative leadership and Governor Whitmer has grown very tense just over the past 24 hours. Can you lay out what happened that ratcheted up the tension?
Yeah, I mean, these relationships, especially between Senate Majority Leader Mike Shirkey and Governor Whitmer, have already been very strained for months, dating back to the budget standoff last fall. But yesterday, there was an incident where the governor's office essentially lobbed a grenade, figuratively, by releasing to reporters internal emails between the governor's staff and the legislative staff that was essentially their, you know, back and forth negotiation over this extending this emergency order. And that ended up being classified by Senate Majority Leader Mike Shirkey as what he called a double middle finger. Then the governor held kind of a more partisan tinged press conference. She had the president of the AFL-CIO on stage, and he was taking shots at the legislature. And that just kind of seems to have really escalated the mistrust on both sides between the governor's office and the legislature. And that doesn't spell well for long-term, you know, management of the state during this crisis right now, particularly because the state government faces anywhere between 2.5 to 3.5 $1 billion shortfall this current fiscal year. That means they got to cut at least $2.5 billion out of the state budget between now and the end of September, plus more billions to cut in the next fiscal year. So these sides, they're going to have to find some unity in order to manage the state through this economic and financial crisis that we face that has come about because of the public health crisis.
We should mention there's a whole other separate track developing. A court of claims judge has in the past day rejected a motion to suspend Governor Whitmer's stay-at-home order in a case that was brought by, I believe, five private citizens. Does that settle the matter in any way?
Well, it definitely gets one court involved. We also, there's a federal lawsuit involving five businesses that have sued challenging the governor's stay home orders. That's been filed in the Western District of Michigan. So far, the governor has been winning the court battles here, but there is this ongoing problem with the legislature wanting some type of role in this crisis. Never mind the fact that we still have 1,000 cases a day rolling in the last couple of days of new cases of coronavirus. And so this political battle seems to be kind of losing track of both the economic problems, the real threat of a depression, and also the ongoing crisis that's still inflicting lots of places across the state, particularly in West Michigan, where we've seen a lot of growth in the number of coronavirus cases.
Anything can happen, but if I'm reading these filings right, the 1945 Emergency Powers Act, which is, I guess, the governor's, you know, last line of defense toward bolstering her emergency powers, doesn't seem to be subject to a court challenge at this time. Less than a minute left here, Chad. Is that your reading of this as well?
That's right. And the only really major difference between these two laws is the 1976 law affords legal immunity and liability protections for frontline workers, doctors, nurses, other medical professionals. And that will be lost if the legislature does not grant an extension of emergency powers under that 1976 law.
Chad Livengood covers public policy and Detroit as a senior editor at Crain's Detroit. Chad, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up, from the protests in Lansing to conversations on Facebook, it's clear that many conservatives are frustrated with Governor Whitmer's stay-at-home orders. And right-wing groups have seized on that frustration as an opportunity to organize.
We know that these were partisan organizations who are looking to make this into a partisan thing.
We'll speak with the chief political correspondent for Politico, Tim Alberta, in just a moment. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Tensions are running high between the Whitmer administration and legislative leaders. Tim Alberta is a senior political correspondent for the website Politico. And as the COVID-19 crisis was ramping up, he was working on a profile of Gretchen Whitmer. And he joins us now to talk further about the ripple effects. Tim Alberta, welcome back to Stateside.
It's great to be back with you.
You know, we called you up, among other things, to ask about the protests in Lansing that have been asking, among other things, for a speedier reopening of business in certain sectors of Michigan's economy. How long did that truce between Governor Whitmer and the Republican legislative leaders last? Was it 1 week, maybe two?
Not real long. You know, what's so interesting, April, is early in the month of April, I had been setting out on a pretty comprehensive reporting project to profile Governor Whitmer. And I was really struck talking with not just former Republicans who served at high levels that she had worked closely alongside, but with current Republican leaders, including the Speaker of the House, Lee Chatfield. And in all of these conversations with folks in writing this pretty lengthy magazine profile of the governor, you could not find one person who had anything really negative to say. And that was including her early handling of the COVID-19 pandemic. There was just a real sense that Republican leaders in the State House were on the same page with her, that they had her back, that this was not going to descend into partisan bickering. And of course, as the laws of journalism would have it, the day I published that magazine profile was the same day that she announced the expanded nature of the emergency stay-at-home order. And that expanded version of it is really when the dam burst. It included, of course, a ban on traveling between residences. It banned landscaping work being done, among other things, and of course prohibited certain items from being purchased at stores. This wasn't sort of a steady upward trajectory in tension between parties in Lansing. It was basically a flat line that spiked suddenly. And when it spiked, it spiked in a big way. You had leaders coming out, lawmakers on the Republican side breaking very vocally with the governor, and you had members of the congressional delegation rebuking her, which had not been the case up until that point. You obviously had these big protests in Lansing. So suddenly it went from zero to 60 virtually overnight. Now things seem to be receding ever so slightly, I think in part because the governor has scaled back some of those guidelines, but also because I think there is a recognition that the end is near to some degree as far as this sort of sweeping nature of the stay-at-home order and the shutdown of many of these businesses.
Do you see anything different between the groundswell of conservative energy that built up over those weeks versus the energy that propelled President Trump to office 4 years ago?
Boy, that's a good question. I certainly think there's a great deal of overlap. I should say
there's been some overlaps in funding. You know, there have been several reports documenting, you know, who was behind some, if not all, of the funding and energy at the state Capitol protests over the past month.
That's absolutely right. I mean, look, whenever you have the opportunity for mass mobilization and mass protests, there are going to be groups that see an opportunity for investment there and really take advantage of it and take what might be sort of a small organic thing and turn it into something that's sort of more manifestly put on or manufactured. And I think that's what was happening in Lansing. I don't doubt for a second that you had some number, maybe not an insignificant number, of citizens from various places who heard about this or read about it on Facebook and who were genuinely worked up and they wanted to come out and beat their horns and show they were unhappy with Gretchen Whitmer, with the government writ large. But yeah, I mean, we know from reporting that's been done, from just sort of tracing the cord back through social media and seeing some of the groups that were doing this organizing and who's funding them, we know that these were partisan organizations who were looking to make this into a partisan thing. And what's interesting about it, April, in my view, is that there's always going to be an opportunity, especially in an election year, to try and score points around something like this. And it shouldn't surprise us that, you know, conservative organizations were going to try and beat up on Gretchen Whitmer right around the time when she's being considered for Joe Biden's running mate, and also Michigan, obviously one of the three or four most important states this fall. But I think what's interesting about it is it's not really all that partisan of a thing. You had protesters in Indiana marching on the state house, which is run by Republicans. And, you know, just in talking with friends, families, neighbors, looking at your crazy Facebook feed, you do sense that there's a lot of people across party lines who feel this anger, this irritation, you know, a real sense of fear and foreboding about what this has in store for them and their family and their businesses. But obviously, you do have some opportunistic actors, and in some cases, just some bad actors who are going to try and exploit it.
What do we know about the groups that were organizing online and providing some funding for the state house groups? I know the Michigan Freedom Foundation was a big part of the organizing in Michigan. What do we know about their history?
You know, stop me if you've heard this before, but a lot of this winds its way back to the DeVos family, and that's not terribly surprising. You know, the DeVos family has been heavily involved with a lot of philanthropic work over the years, of course, and we also know about their business ties. But the DeVos family also is easily one of the five or six most influential families in Republican politics over the last, you know, decade or so. They have been involved with everything from state legislative races, ballot initiatives, congressional races, obviously being involved at the presidential level. We know that in no small part, Betsy DeVos wound up as Secretary of Education because of her ties to Mike Pence, who was able to persuade Donald Trump to put her in the cabinet. I digress. The point being that the DeVos family and their allies, political allies, have always sort of had their hands in everything. Some of the operatives who are closely affiliated with them, among others, Greg McNeely, they are at the helm of some of these organizations that were instrumental in doing this organizing. What's really interesting is that you've actually seen a number of these essentially sister organizations, sister chapters, pop up in the span of about 72 hours online. So you saw Michiganders Against Excessive Quarantine on Facebook. You saw a similar group in Ohio, a similar group in Pennsylvania. And it doesn't take a whole lot of sleuthing to, as I said, sort of trace the cord back and figure out where the power and where the money is coming from. And so in a state like Michigan, especially where you've seen some of these big fights on ballot initiatives and where you've seen some of these fights over everything from charter schools to right to work, it took about 30 seconds to look at those protests and to check out your Facebook feed and to read a few of the familiar names and to realize where this was coming from.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Tim Alberta, chief political correspondent for Politico. He has a recent article profiling Michigan Governor Gretchen Whitmer. We're talking with him about election year politics involving Whitmer and many others. Tim, Donald Trump pretty famously tapped into a silent majority, voters who were embarrassed to say that they supported Trump, but who nonetheless voted for him in 2016. Do you think he still lays claim to that territory?
It feels more and more like the silent majority is now a very outspoken minority. One of the phenomena of the Trump political era, I think, April, is to sort of study the Trump voter who will tell you that they have soured on him in some way, that they wish he would stop tweeting, that some of what he says and does kind of drives them crazy, and yet they are 100% committed to his quest for reelection. And then they will talk to you openly about why. Oftentimes it has every bit as much to do with what the Democrats are doing as with what the administration is doing. I raise that point because many of these people would have fit the bill of part of that silent majority 4 years ago. They might have felt socially uncomfortable copping to the fact that they were supporting Donald Trump. And now they're quite open about it. And in some part, it almost feels like it's been jarred loose from them, this sort of ongoing culture war and the constant, what many of them will view as the sort of partisan media complex attacking Donald Trump from the left, that it has emboldened them in some way to come to his defense, even while there's some dissonance here, because they will themselves sort of acknowledge that, yeah, that's totally inappropriate what he just said, or gosh, I wish he wouldn't have tweeted this thing. And so I don't know that it's fair to even call it a silent majority anymore. I don't feel like all that many people are still silent. I think the battle lines have been drawn in a pretty visible way at this point. The question is still going to be, come November, can Donald Trump simultaneously turn out all of these people who voted for him in 2016 while doing enough to sort of depress enthusiasm and energy on the Democratic side? Because that's been his MO since day one. It's not just about promoting his own candidacy. It's about taking the air out of the other candidates. A big part of Donald Trump's political success to date has been to sort of win by process of disqualifying his opponent.
I noticed that on Twitter recently, you noted some polling about Trump losing ground with older voters. Why do you think that is?
Well, I think it's a huge problem if it lasts, and there's just not enough evidence right now to even suggest that it could. What we had seen, though, in a period of a couple of weeks, to step back and contextualize this a little bit, basically, every good pollster right now is attempting to measure this question among voters of, is your biggest concern about public health or is your biggest concern about economics? Obviously, for many people, they aren't mutually exclusive. It's a matter of prioritizing. And so what you've seen in polling over the last few weeks is that a pretty healthy majority of the country had been prioritizing public health over the economy, but that gap has been winnowing pretty consistently over the last 3 weeks or so. What's interesting is that the one group that has been a holdout from day one and that the numbers really aren't moving much with is among older voters, 65 plus, for obvious reasons. They are the people who are the most likely to die if they are infected by the coronavirus.
Not to mention slightly removed from the workforce.
That's exactly right. Yes, I would be remiss if I didn't mention, of course, yeah, that many of them are retired, right? So they don't have to worry about losing their job. And so when you put those things together you can understand why they would be predisposed to prioritize the public health concern. What we saw as a corollary from that, and we haven't, again, we haven't seen it sustained, but it'll be interesting to study over the next couple of months, is, you know, Donald Trump has lost ground among those voters, because clearly some of them believe that he does not prioritize public health as much as he prioritizes economic health. Whether or not that sort of provides an opening for Joe Biden, it remains to be seen whether he can exploit it, whether he can capitalize on it. But when you look at how the margins broke down in 2016, you know, Donald Trump only won seniors in Michigan by 4 points. In Wisconsin, he won them by only 1 point. So there's not a whole lot of margin for error. And we know one thing about seniors, it's that they vote. 65 plus is a very reliable voting demographic, so it's not one that Donald Trump can afford to lose any ground with.
Tim, to your point about the extent to which the Trump campaign will want to try to depress the turnout for Joe Biden, nobody has to tell election watchers in Michigan that African American voters are important to this presidential contest. The chestnut is no turnout. You don't get a win in Michigan. Considering the fact that the COVID virus has been so deadly and so devastating in African American communities, do you think the Democratic Party is any closer to closing a sale with voters who, you know, maybe turned out for Barack Obama and maybe had second thoughts about Hillary Clinton and who are now seeing their communities devastated?
Yeah, it's such an important question. There is reason for some cautious optimism if you're a Democrat, because Joe Biden has a relationship by proxy with Barack Obama, with the Black community, that Hillary Clinton just did not. And you will see organically more enthusiasm for a Joe Biden and more of a sense of trust and sort of intimacy, as much intimacy as a random rank-and-file voter can have with a presidential candidate. People feel that with Joe Biden in a way that they simply did not feel it with Hillary Clinton. So to that degree, yes, I would say that Biden starts in a better position than did Hillary Clinton. At the same time, there is a ton of work to be done, specifically not just work in terms of getting on the ground and shaking hands and doing the field operating work to get out the vote. There is work to be done to ensure that some of these neighborhoods, some of these communities that have been devastated by COVID-19, as you said, that they have sufficient access to voting precincts where they feel that they are safe and where they can go there and vote and not have to worry about their public health. And, you know, that is something that we haven't even really begun to grapple with, really. Every 4 years, presidential campaigns have to deal with a whole new set of circumstances, but generally they all fall within the same sort of general orbit. This is something totally new. And I can tell you from talking with Democrats over the last few weeks, it's something they're immensely concerned about, because if you don't have high turnout in some of these really densely packed urban centers that are heavily minority precincts, you're not going to win. And these are the areas that we've seen hit the hardest so far by the virus. And if it comes back with a vengeance this fall, as many health professionals are expecting, then that presents sort of a perfect storm to see depressed turnout on the Democratic side.
Let's turn things back to the state scene for just one more moment. In your profile of Governor Whitmer, we really got the sense as readers that she's someone who isn't deterred by bullies, but on the contrary, can let her haters be motivators. But that was before the protests at the state capitol. Do you see Gretchen Whitmer possibly being able to message her way through the turn of events with coronavirus?
She's trying. You know, it's interesting that the emergency stay-at-home order was scheduled to expire on May 1st. And it's interesting that last week, in advance of that expiration, she came out and decided to scale things back. She's not going to get up to the podium and wave a white flag, but in some ways, that's what it was. It was very clear that she was going to have to do something to scale back this order, not just because of the protests, but because people around her who have her own best interests at heart were making it known to her that, look, this just, it overreached a little bit. Look, politicians make mistakes every day. Elected officials are not infallible, far from it. They make mistakes all the time, both in policy and in politics. The best thing you can do is rectify it really quickly. And from my vantage point, having been in and around her orbit for the better part of a month now, really closely sort of monitoring what's been happening, it was apparent almost immediately that she had overreached a little bit with that expansion of the order. If she had acted a little more quickly to rectify it, then you probably wouldn't have seen 4,000 people show up in Lansing. And then once they did show up, if she had retracted it immediately, then that would have looked very cut and dried, like she was doing so in response that she had been bullied or she had been cowed by those protests. So she sort of boxed herself in a little bit there. And now the question is going to be, as we move forward and as the partisanship sort of ratchets up here, I mean, her numbers are still in pretty good shape, but clearly she is a far more polarizing figure today than she was 3 or 3.5 weeks ago. As Republicans in the state house have become sort of emboldened to go after her, and as the Trump White House goes after her, how does she respond? Does she sort of go into an attack position, or does she sort of let it roll off her back as she is sort of known to do and kind of play it cool and not show that she is frustrated by this? Because she's in a really tricky spot all the while, of course, auditioning for this role of Vice President of the United States with all eyes on her right now.
Tim Alberta is chief political correspondent for Politico. We'll include a link to his profile of Gretchen Whitmer at our website. Tim, crazy times. We have sympathy for a political reporter who can't actually be out on the campaign trail right now. So best of luck, and we're looking forward to more stuff you're filing this year.
Well, thank you. And I appreciate you guys having me on. Hope everybody is doing okay in your households and everybody's keeping their sanity in these insane times.
Coming up, we check in with Avalon International Bread's owner, Jackie Victor. She says she's been experiencing some problems with the PPP loan program from the federal government. That's next on Stateside. Stay with us. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. This week, you might have seen an op-ed piece from the New York Times that was widely shared on social media, telling the story of Detroit's Avalon International Breads. Avalon has rapidly expanded its business over the past 5 years and was settling into its new growth when the coronavirus upended everything. If you've ever had an Avalon sea salt chocolate chip cookie, you know this is a Michigan treasure that would be a tragedy to lose. Jackie Victor is the owner and founder of Avalon International. Jackie, welcome to Stateside.
Hi, thank you, April.
You opened up your flagship bakery in the 1990s on Willis Street in Midtown. Of course, now we say Midtown, and it's a bit of an economic hub in Detroit, but this was not always the case. Can you talk to us about what the area looked like when you first opened operations?
Yeah, absolutely. So we always joke that it'll always be the Cass Corridor to us because that's what it was called back in the 90s. And this was before the reinvestment in Detroit and businesses were and people were still moving out. And so although it was close to Wayne State, close to the DIA, close to the medical center, it really was not considered a viable commercial district. And in fact, we were told it was too far south of Wayne State to be safe even. There weren't a lot of small businesses. There were people living there, for sure, just very economically sort of diverse, not the higher end, residential properties that are there now at all. But there were students, there were artists. It was really a scrappy community. But the big thing is people were coming in and out of the neighborhood and they weren't stopping for anything. So they would drive in from, the suburbs through I-75 or the lodge. They would go to the hospital. They would go to the Wayne State. There were tens of thousands, 100,000 people coming in and out every day. But people weren't stopping to buy anything. So when we first opened, we saw an opportunity, but we also believed in the city and believed that it needed a hearth, and we wanted to be sort of an example of a business that could do good and do well. And we loved the city and loved the neighborhood. But the number one thing people said when we opened our doors was literally, "Thank you for opening a place where I can spend my money." It was mind blowing. So we hit a nerve for sure.
And so, as of say this past winter, I understand you were up to more than 100 employees.
We were. About six years ago, we started a really quite large expansion where we moved our facility, our baking facilities into a large bakehouse, a 50,000 square foot bakehouse on the east side of Detroit. And so we've been baking there. And then we opened up three other cafes, one in New Center, a casual, quick casual restaurant downtown right near Campus Martius, and a full service restaurant actually in Ann Arbor. And so we are operating in still, of course, our flagship store, which we all love and know. So we've been operating for retail and then this large production facility as well. So we had a total of about 135 employees taking all those facilities into account.
Jackie, could you talk a little bit about who's worked at Avalon over the years?
Who's worked? I think everybody. We have had a lot of people work for us in 24 years. But we just had so many different kinds of folks. And I think what's special about Avalon, and to this day, is the diversity of people. It's such a, you know, such a sort of cliche word anymore, but it really is true. Everything from race to class to socioeconomics to education to gender identity to just culture. It really is a place where a wide variety of people come together and work together, you know, towards a common good, but also it's a job. And to that end, it's a workplace like any other workplace.
How were you feeling about the state of the business this past winter, say in January?
Well, it's an interesting question. I think like a lot of businesses, like a lot of people, like all of us, I guess, this crisis has maybe shone light on all of our underlying conditions, right? And so we had a lot of challenges over the last 5 years in this really rapid growth. We were just getting on the other side of that. We were just building up the capacity that we needed to make the bakehouse, actually, it's a 50,000 square foot bakehouse, so it's really big. And we were just working on some distribution contracts and also some, it's called co-packing, so creating products for other companies, as well as our retail. So we were just turning the corner and really like weeks from making, from really turning it around when this all came crashing down. Yeah. So the bad part of that is, of course, that we were weeks away from turning around when it all came crashing down. The good part, though, for us, and the part that I think does make us really lucky, and I do feel really privileged about this, is throughout the last 5 years, we have built an incredible team. I have amazing partners. I have an amazing leadership team. I have amazing staff, and I have a CFO, or COO CFO, who's all of 25 years old, who's brilliant and so hardworking. So we really had the relationships internally, and we had a plan. Even though we had to pivot, we were able to immediately, the day we shut, we laid off everybody except Franz, our COO, and he spent the next 2 weeks, literally 12 hours a day, working on these PPP applications.
You write in your op-ed that getting one of the payroll protection program loans was really just the first hurdle, and that figuring out how to spend it is another matter entirely. Can you explain the predicament that you and the CFO found yourself in once you realized the loan was coming through?
So, I mean, I think it's important, you know, for everyone to recognize that, look, this program is massive, massive program, the largest, you know, by far the largest, you know, small business support program in U.S. history, was created in about a week. And it was created at a time where I think the idea was businesses were going to probably be shut down for about 2 weeks. And the idea was to keep people off unemployment. And then over the next 4 weeks, help everybody get back up and going. Well, clearly that didn't happen, because we laid basically everybody off. The PPP program was announced 2 weeks later, and then we got it 2 weeks later after that. So it was a month after everybody was laid off that we actually received the money. So the major constraint of the program is it's designed to replace payroll, right? So it's designed to pay your payroll. And if you use the loan money for payroll, at least 75% of it, then it will be forgiven. That loan will be forgiven 100%. Well, that sounds great and perfect and what everybody would need, but here's the problem. It has to be used within 60 days, and you have to use, in order for it to be given 100, forgiven 100%, you have to use it at 100% of what your average previous payroll had been the 2.5 months before.
So it's assuming a level of demand under normal business conditions.
Exactly. And again, I think it was, you know, it was made thinking this is going to be a short problem. Well, nobody could have imagined how the economy has bottomed out. So here we are, we have the money, we are ready to spend it, but the problem is there's almost no demand. So for right now, we've started to employ a very small number of people at the bakehouse just to start to provide bread for the grocery stores again. And it's hard enough to just get people back because it's dangerous, right? It's dangerous to come out of the house, especially in Detroit. People are very nervous, and rightly so.
When you say it's dangerous, you mean it's dangerous for people's health.
Right.
Because of the high COVID infection rate in the city of Detroit.
Exactly. And so anyone, basically, if you have to take public transportation, it's not a risk worth taking, right now. So that eliminates a whole bunch of people. But in any case, you know, how about if you are caring for an elderly parent, or you're caring for someone who's immunocompromised? Even if our workplace is as safe as we can make it, there's a possibility that you could interact with people and you could bring it home. So there's a lot of, and because it's so intense in Detroit, there's a lot of fear around that. And those are valid fears. So, and we're trying to make it as safe as possible, but you know, to be honest, we're ramping up too. We're trying to figure this out in real time. And it's not, you know, we're a small company. It's not that easy. So anyway, so we have a small number of employees right now, about 13 employees right now, including all our managers who are back and getting ready, you know, getting the retail ready to get back. But it's hard to know how to spend the money because this money won't be forgiven within 60 days, we don't have all of our employees back.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Jackie Victor. She's the owner and founder of Avalon International Breads, located in Detroit. Jackie, have you given much thought to what's going to happen going forward? You had, as you mentioned, expanded the business quite a lot into grocery stores, also opening some more restaurants. What do you think the restaurant side of the business is going to look like for the next couple of years?
Yeah, that is the, right, I mean, that's the rub. This is the real, this is the problem, and this is the fear of everybody in the food business, is that, I mean, we're lucky in that we do have sort of a diversified business. We don't only do grocery stores. We don't only do restaurants. We don't only do distribution. We don't only do co-packing. We do a number of different things. So we at least might have 20% of our business that we can, you know, recreate without the restaurants. But I think it's going to be very, very slow. I don't think any of us know what it's going to look like. We obviously short term have to assume that it's going to be pretty much takeout only. Very few people are going to want to sit at a restaurant. But in some states, we've heard that they're only allowing 25% of seating, maybe 50% to begin with. But to think of most food businesses barely make it. Very few businesses are highly profitable. And so to think of having the basic overhead you need for a restaurant and you can only seat 50% of the people, that's a very tough business model. So I think people are going to have to pivot their business models.
You know, I imagine in a business that's as diversified as yours has become, you know, as the owner, you probably have parts of it that are sort of like your favorite children. Mm-hmm. Do you worry that as you retool the business for the things that are going to happen over the next couple of years, you might have to cut back on the parts of it that are more meaningful to you?
Well, what's interesting is that we've been really playing with that a lot throughout the last 5 years as we've had to build up this sort of engine of the bakehouse, which isn't the sexiest part of the business. Manufacturing, you know, I've come to find is really not that sexy, but it's critical to the long-term economic health, not only of our business, but also to the jobs that we're trying to provide. I think, you know, the retail part of the business, that's, you know, that's the part where I love, and that's the part where I thrive, because I love people and, you know, I love community, and that's why I started the business. How that changes and pivots is I worry about it, But I also think that's where we have a lot of, that's where we really can use our creativity. And that's where I have a lot of creative people as part of my team. And that's also where, I mean, I can't tell you all the people in the community that we've heard from, even before this New York Times article, but since then, we're like, what can I do? How can I help? And of course, yeah, buy gift certificates, all that stuff. Great. And people are doing it. And it's amazing. And once we reopen, what I'm saying is help us spread the word about whatever we're doing. Help us spread the word. And we started, yeah, I remember in 1987, we started before really the internet, before social media, before Spig. We did the real viral marketing where I would tell you and you would tell someone else. So we know how to do that, to create something that people want to talk about and need to share. So yeah, I am, I'd be lying if I'd say I'm not worried. I am worried, and I'm worried about how many jobs that we can sustain and how we can create them and at what level, and I'm 100% committed to that. And I am confident that we will come out of this with the same, you know, heart and soul that we have had, however it looks. This is a very sad time. Very sad time, not only for the country, but for the city of Detroit. We, you know, the city of Detroit's being ravaged, just decimated in terms of this public health aspect as well as the economics. So I feel like Avalon has a very important role to play in that healing, and we will we'll be there to play it no matter what it looks like.
I'm sure that this isn't the first time you've dealt with financial strain. I mean, Avalon did survive the Great Recession in Detroit. Do you think you can bring the business out of this as well?
Well, we will bring the business out. I mean, scrappy is what we do. It's how we started. It was, you know, there was nothing scrappier than Detroit when we started. And so we, you know, one of my mentors, my political mentors, is a beloved man named James Boggs. And he used to say, we have to find a way, of making something out of nothing. And so that's what we're going to have to do. So we will survive. I can't imagine. I won't imagine anything other than survival. But what it's going to look like is what we just can't, we can't wrap our brains around right now. Nobody can. It won't look the same. There's no way anyone's business, nobody's food business can look the same. And even grocery stores are looking different, and they're doing a lot of business. But the difference with the recessions before was, actually, interestingly, bakeries do well in recessions. If you can't buy a car.
That's kind of a no-brainer, just from everyone who's stress eating right now.
Right? You got it. Okay. You get that on a body level. You get that. So that's different than now, because people would want to come together. They would want to congregate. They'd want to sit and have a cup of coffee, maybe treat themselves to an extra sea salt cookie or a sticky butt. Well, now people can't come together and they can't congregate, or they're anxious to do that, or they don't have jobs. And so it's not just that they have less jobs, but, you know, so that's what we don't know. But I think what we do, here's what I do know. I do know that people will always need to have a sense of community. I do know that that bread and baked goods will always feed something in human beings that is way beyond our bodies. It is literally soul food. That is why we started Avalon, to create a community hearth. So how we bring that hearth to people in the suburbs and in the city, and how we create that hearth in other ways maybe that aren't even just food, that's our challenge, and we're up for it. But it is going to be a very challenging, really painful road ahead. And I believe that I believe Detroit in general, we have the grit more than anyone else to figure out a way out of no way.
It's beautiful. Jackie Victor, the owner and founder of Avalon International Breads. Jackie, thank you so much, and good luck with the business.
Thank you, April. I appreciate it.
That's Stateside for today. Tomorrow on the program, the cancellation of Holland, Michigan's Tulip Time Festival. It's having a huge impact on the community.
I'm going to miss being on the streets and asking people where they're from, seeing people be happy and come from all over the nation and even the world to visit Holland and the Tulips is really pretty fascinating and special to be able to talk to those folks.
We'll talk about the 90-year tradition and how you can still enjoy the flowers tomorrow on Stateside. Our show's producers are Mike Blank, April Van Buren, Laura Weber Davis, and Mercedes Mejia. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm April Baer. Thanks for being here. We'll catch you on Friday.